it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's a donut and fruit show, as in grapes for a desperately misunderstood wine, an apple that changed the world, and a fruit that makes eaters blush. Food historian John T. Edge has a dissertation on Homer Simpson's favorite food, the donut. His book is Donuts, An American Passion. Wine expert Letty Teague says Chablis is not a California jug wine. It's a noble French soul that's wonderfully undervalued. We meet the creator of the apple that's changing the world. At least that's what the award said. Russ Parsons of the LA Times tells all about the fresh fig, the fruit that can make you blush. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years. Jane and Michael write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I was just in New Mexico, and I was thinking about you, too. Have you been down there recently? Because you always find the great places.
Actually, we were in southern New Mexico very recently, and we were in the Mesilla Valley, where they grow so many of the chilies that are unique to the state of New Mexico. We went to a restaurant there in La Mesa. This restaurant is surrounded by chili fields. I mean, literally surrounded. Huh. There's nothing around it other than chili fields. This is where the planters go. And need I mention that the menu is extremely chili-centric and oh so good. I mean, this place actually dates back to 1915 when the grandmother of the woman who runs it now started selling enchiladas to local farmers, and it eventually became a bar and a restaurant, and it's still a very local kind of casual place. People come and go, and everybody knows each other, and the menu, if you're interested in real New Mexican food, is just brilliant.
What's on it? What's on
well, the number one thing, of course, is chili rellenos. I mean, because, you know, you get those all throughout the Southwest and elsewhere, but this is where to have it, because they're battered and fried, you know, and stuffed with cheese. But and the cheese is good, the batter is good, the frying is good, but what's so good is the chili pod itself. It's still kind of a little bit al dente, and it really has the flavor of chili. I mean, not all that hot even, but just that earthy, sunshiny, green flavor of a real New Mexican chili pod is just unlike anything else in the world.
If you want to be the enemy at Chopes, mention chili powder. They absolutely think chili powder is the devil's invention. Chili powder, according to the people at Chopes, makes everything bitter. So you have to use the whole pod, and you have to boil it down, and you have to mash it, or you puree it. And that is the basis of everything, including the green chili cheeseburgers, which sound like, you know, no big deal, but are wonderful.
When green chili is good, it's almost like, you know, a deity experience. It can be that wonderful. What do they do much with red chili?
Yeah, well, they do. What Jane was talking about when they, you know, when they act, what they make is what they call simply chili, which is a bowl of pureed red chilies, maybe a little salt, possibly a little garlic. It is simply essence of chili, the most concentrated chili flavor you can possibly imagine. And of course, that chili, it's not a meal like you would get in Texas. You know, when they say chili in Texas, that's a meal. In New Mexico, at least hereabouts, chili is something to use on enchiladas, on some breakfast dishes. It's something that is used in a gordita with ground meat or chicken or pot roast. It's something that you might make chili con carne out of. But the chili itself is the key to the flavor.
And I'm sure I'm not the only person who, when the waitress puts down a basket of hot tortilla chips with homemade green chili salsa, truly the meal could end there for me. I mean, it is that prelude to the meal is to me one of the greatest parts of it.
And I'll tell you something interesting, Lynn, about this place is that nothing on the menu is ferociously hot. We were talking with Cecilia Benavides, who is the daughter of Chope, and also at our table was a woman who is a chili grower, and also Paul Bosland, who is sort of the dean of chili breeders in that part of the world.
He's at the university.
At the University of New Mexico. And all of us were discussing chilies and good and hot and this and that. And, you know, so many of us Northerners go down there and expect ferocious heat, and we want the hotter the better. And they were saying, no, that's really for tourists. And, you know, they have it. If they have locally grown jalapenos, and they will give you a ferociously hot sauce if you ask for it. But otherwise, I mean, it's spicy and it's hot, but it's not that ferocious heat that a lot of chili heads crave.
So if you really want to embarrass yourself, you'll ask for extra hot chili powder. Then you will be hitting all the wrong notes.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Thanks, Lynn.
Gina Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a new recipe designed to make your worknight suppers a little easier. And check out our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. You're going to find it all and so much more on the website, splendidtable.org. When we get to wine, we always talk about undiscovered gems, usually from obscure locations. Well, there's a flip side. It's the gem that's been around forever, comes from a favorite place, but everybody's forgotten about it. Well, this state of affairs, by the way, usually means it's undervalued. One such jewel is French, white, and it's called Chablis. Food & Wine magazine's executive wine editor Letty Teague tracked the wine to its source in France. Letty, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here, Lynn.
You know, Letty, I want to start at the very beginning. Now, this is what's confusing. Chablis is a Burgundy, it's a Chardonnay,
right.
And it's a Chablis.
Right.
Can you lay this out?
It's so many things all at once.
Yes, exactly. Here's
the scoop on Chablis. Chablis is one of the six subregions of Burgundy, okay? And the white grape of Burgundy is Chardonnay.
And in Burgundy, the wine takes the name of the place, not the grape.
Exactly. So that is why it's always Chablis, not Chardonnay.
So you're saying that the French Chablis that we can drink taste nothing like the California Chablis that we can drink in this country.
California Chardonnay, Lynn. Where is no California Chablis?
Thank you. Okay.
The French will slap you around if you try using one of their place names for a Chardonnay made in Sonoma.
I think I'd accept the abuse if I could get a really great Chablis.
I thought you were going to say if it looks like a really cute Frenchman. Okay. Okay, well, California Chardonnay is almost inevitably going to be an oaked wine. Chablis almost never spends any time in oak. So it has a clarity, and you taste only the fruit and the soil. And the soil type is called Kimmeridgian, and that's actually named after a village in England called Kimmeridge. And what it is it's this really chalky white soil that in fact is the same soil as, you know, you'll see in the White Cliffs of Dover, you know, chalky.
Right.
Yeah. It's this limestone and clay soil that's just absolutely unique in the world. And so it produces this wine that fascinates me because there is no other wine in the whole wide world that tastes like Chablis. There is no Chardonnay made anywhere in the world that tastes quite like Chablis. And that has, you know, a great deal to do with this really extraordinary, unique soil.
So what does it taste like?
You know, there are two different types, and that's the young Chablis and old Chablis. And that is what really makes Chablis, again, unique in the world, is that it's a white wine that ages. And, you know, that's not true of many white wines.
Right.
When it's young, it has a real sort of bright and lively acidity. Well, it has a great acidity throughout its life, but it has a sort of wonderful green, apple-y quality. It can be floral. It can be very minerally. I mean, minerally is an oft-used word to describe Chablis, and that, again, relates back to the soil.
Right.
As it ages, it takes on a richness and a roundness and a deepness that almost makes it like a Cote d'Or white. You know, it has that,
that
it is Burgundy. Yeah, that lushness, that richness, but again with that same wonderful thread of minerality and that great acidity in which that's what enables Chablis to live a very long time is this tremendously high level of acidity, which can be difficult to take in its youth, you know, because, I mean, people don't really like huge amounts of acidity, even though that's what makes it a really good food wine.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. What do you eat with Chablis?
Yeah. You know, it's actually pretty, it's remarkably versatile. You can have all the dishes you would associate with a very crisp, dry, lively white, you know, shellfish. But you can also have very rich dishes like, you know, lobster and fish and cream sauce because, again, you have that brilliant counterpoint of acidity.
So can you name some names for us? This is what I'm thinking. Can you give us a couple of entry-level Chablis, something maybe with modest price for those of us who haven't had it?
Right.
And then what I'd love you to pick is the Chablis that's extraordinary, the one that if we want to blow the budget and have an investment wine and taste it
You will
it
have to
Old's
blow
glory.
The budget.
Right. Well, I'm ready.
Okay. All right. First, we'll start out small. You know, and it's not that Chablis is dead cheap, like basic Chablis, but we're talking a wine at a very high quality. You can get a simple AC, which is, you know, village Chablis, for about $20 a bottle. Mm-hmm. And right now we're in the 2004 vintage going into the 2005. Both are very good vintages. 2005 looks to be extraordinary. I would say three producers to look for their simplest wine, just their straight Chablis. One is Domaine William Fevre, and it's F-E-V-R-E.
Right.
And Domaine Laroche, L-A-R-O-C-H-E.
Mm-hmm.
And Christian Moreau, M-O-R-E-A-U.
And then for the bottle that will...
That all the collectors want?
Yes, that the earth will move and will... And...
The earth will move. And even if it doesn't, you're going to convince yourself it did because it costs so darn much money. But it is the 2002, which was a great vintage in Chablis. The producer's name is Raveneau. And that's a producer that every collector knows. It's R-A-V-E-N-E-A-U. 2002 Le Clos, and that's a Grand Cru vineyard. It's considered the greatest Grand Cru. He's considered the greatest producer. It's a great vintage. A bottle of that it was probably going to set you back $400,
$450. So I don't pay the mortgage.
But exactly. You have a choice. You know? Do you want to make your creditors happy or do you want to make your friends happy? I mean, I know which is, it's easy for me to choose, which is. Yeah.
I don't know. I think, I have a theory that before you die, at least one truly great wine should pass over your lips.
Lynn, that's a very bad theory. I think at least 700 great wines before you die.
Well, I start out modest.
Okay.
Hey, Letty, thank you.
Thanks so much, Lynn. It's been great fun.
Letty Teague is executive wine editor for Food & Wine magazine. Her article on Chablis appeared in the September 2006 issue. Now, you can get Letty's Chablis finds on the website, splendidtable.org.
What?
And on that very same site, you can sign up for our new Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Every week you get a new recipe, and as usual, this newsletter's free. Now it begins in October for a limited run, so sign up now. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, the donut as patriot and movie star, and the apple named one of the 25 innovations that changed the world. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Every country has iconic foods, even if people don't eat them all the time. Take apple pie. Eat it all the time? Nah. But are we as American as it? Absolutely. Well, food historian John T. Edge curates American edibles. He tracks the evolution of our icons in all their quirky glory. John's covered that apple pie, fried chicken, and the duo of burgers and fries. His latest project is about a food that's not quite as obvious as those first three. John's book is Donuts, an American Passion. Hey, John T., welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. Glad to be with you.
So, John T., I have to say, when I think donut, I don't necessarily think of it as American. Is there an American history of the donut?
There is. And, you know, I didn't know it until I started digging. I think that we can all recognize that the donut we know in America came to us by way of the Dutch. But we made it American quite quickly. And it happened in two ways. One, World War I came along, mm-hmm. and the Salvation Army lassies, women who were sent overseas, over to France, to minister to the troops, hit upon donuts as a way of showing their love, of showing compassion for the troops. You know, they might have wanted to bake pies, they might have wanted to bake home-cooked meals, but what they did instead was fry donuts. Portable cook stoves, rigged up with hot oil. It was easy, it was expedient, they cooked up cheap. And those donuts, those simple cake donuts, came to be a symbol of American kind of forthrightness, American can-do attitude behind the lines among these women who were ministering to, you know, the boys who were over there fighting in the trenches.
And this was also that, because this is the beginning of the 1900s, right? I'm thinking this is that era when the class system was changing in this country, and this idea of being the everyman, being the common man, was something that was really, people took great pride in that. And the donut, it sounds like the donut really represented some of that.
It did. It also, you know, the recognition of the donut's possibility was birthed in World War I. Upon exit from the war, a lot of these soldiers saw the donut as their path to economic self-sufficiency. The government went so far, the War Department went so far, is to issue pamphlets on how to open your own donut shop.
Really?
Yeah. And this was one of the career options espoused by the military. And it was a path like, you know, like many of the foods that we know now, like hamburgers, like fried chicken. It was a path to economic sustainability. It was a path to the American dreams. And for many people coming out of World War I, donuts provided that.
Huh. So you had a pot of oil and you had some dough and you could open a business, serve some coffee and you were there.
Yeah, I mean, the startup costs are really cheap, and you saw not only World War I veterans, but you also see, in later years, new immigrants to America who take up the donut as their own.
So it's up there with the pizza parlor as the great entry-level
yeah.
business. So what happened next?
Well, this idea of the donut being a path to economic self-sufficiency merges with the kind of industrial model that America was embracing after the Industrial Revolution, this idea of faster, cheaper, better, this idea that a food was better if it was produced without the touch of a human hand, if a machine was the method of throughput for the food. A gentleman named Adolph Levitt came up with the amazing almost human donut machine.
Was that what it was called?
Yeah, this kind of Rube Goldberg-like device that stopped traffic in Times Square during that age, but also, iterations of that, different versions of that, spread all across the country. And it's the same formula. It's buy your machine, buy your ingredients, crank them out by the dozens, by the hundreds, and serve people day in, day out. This PR campaign comes behind it. Levitt had the Donut Machine Corporation of America, and there was a donut magazine that came out during the same period, in the 20s and 30s. If you, like me, are inclined to read stacks of old magazines and inclined to go to the New York Public Library, you can peruse the back issues wherein the Donut Corporation of America says that you should be eating donut sandwiches and donut desserts made, you know, topped with frills of whipped cream. It was this huge PR push.
Mm-hmm. John T., there's fried dough all over the world, but sure. I think of as an American donut has a hole. Where did the hole come from?
Well, the hole is, we'll never be able to plumb the depths of the hole. We'll never know where the hole came from. But we tell a heck of a lot of good stories about it, including one of my favorites, which is the story of a seaman, and mm-hmm. he was aboard the ship Frypan. And while munching a fried cake, Mr. Gregory was thrown to the deck by a swell, and upon clambering to his feet, he impaled his fry cake on the ship's wheel to save it for later, of course, I'm sure for dunking, and thus the hole was born. It's probably a load of hooey. It's almost certainly a load of hooey.
I love the image.
But in many cases, who cares? You know, it's a great story.
Hey, John T., thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Food historian John T. Edge is author of Donuts, An American Passion. Now, we put a recipe from the book on the website. Check out Zingerman's Roadhouse Donuts at splendidtable.org. Would you believe that an apple was recently named one of the 25 innovations that changed the world? Well, that designation came from the Association of University Technology Managers, and it puts an apple up there with the V-chip and the Google search engine. Well, the apple they're talking about is probably in your supermarket. It's the Honeycrisp, and it tastes exactly as the name says, sweet with unstoppable crunch and some real flavor behind the sugar. But as far as changing the world, well, for that piece, we have one of the two scientists who developed the Honeycrisp. He is the University of Minnesota's apple breeder, Dr. David Bedford. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
So I know the Honeycrisp is a great apple, but what sets it apart? I mean, is it emblematic of a change in how apples are being dealt with commercially?
Well, I think so. And what sets it apart? It's the texture. I think Honeycrisp has sort of become the definition of crisp in the new mode of apples.
How do you create an apple?
Well, it's a slow process, I can tell you that. It starts by breeding, hybridizing. We take pollen from one apple and put it onto the flowers of another and create a hybrid seed. And then that seed and many seeds are raised until they're large enough to produce fruit, and then we select the ones that really stand out.
And I guess what I want to know is, what is your day like? Because you do the selection, right?
Yep. That is the hard part, actually. You know, the breeding is pretty easy. That only takes about 3 to 5 days a year. It's the next 15 years of selecting and testing that really are hard. And it really comes down to, sooner or later, tasting every one of those apples. And in a good day of evaluating the 25,000 or so trees that we have, it would involve eating and evaluating about 500 to 600 apples a day.
What are the standards for those apples?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the standards for apples in the past, from what I can see, have been all about appearance. Our standards, our two most important standards for our breeding program, are texture and flavor.
What is your dream apple as an apple breeder? I mean, if I could, the utopian apple for you.
Yeah, well, I definitely would start with Honeycrisp texture. Mm-hmm. And then I would maybe work in some of the exotic flavors that we actually have found in some other apples. For example, we've got a little known apple that was released years ago called Sweet 16. And that apple, when it's fully ripe and picked and grown properly, actually tastes like a cherry lifesaver when it's fully ready.
Oh, my. That sounds fabulous. Well, now, you brought in three apples. Now, one of them is a little, it almost looks like an oversized crab apple, and it's sort of blushed with gold and pink and red. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. One is a yellow apple with a lot of brownish wheat-colored webbing on it. It's kind of nubbly. Mm. And then there's a big one here that, again, is this lovely cherry orangey red with pale green. What are we looking at?
Well, the smallest one you mentioned is actually a new selection that I just made about 3 days ago. So out of our breeding program, that one will go on for another 10 to 15 years of testing. Now, the chances are that it will be eliminated because most of the things in the program do get eliminated. But that one right now is getting a second chance to go on and prove itself.
What's the name of it?
It only has a number.
Okay. I'm going to give it a quick taste. Okay.
See what you think.
It has a sort of soft texture. Oh, my. It tastes like sweet. It tastes exactly like sweet apple cider.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, I gave it to my wife actually earlier in the week, and that was her assessment, too.
Okay, now the yellow one. The yellow one is...
Now, that one I make no predictions or... I really brought it in for its unusual appearance.
Okay. I like the idea of an apple that isn't a beauty star.
Yeah, well, that's good. We've got a bunch for you.
Oh, man. Lemon, sweet, very crunchy. I would love this apple in baking, and I love it on the table. I can just imagine this with blue cheese.
Interesting.
This is delicious.
Good, good. And, in fact, that sort of represents some of the flavors that we like, in that we'd like something with high sugar and high acid. And people say, well, I like a sweet apple. But if you take away the acid and only have the sugar, you end up with Kool-Aid, sort of.
It's
sugar
bland.
And water. That's right.
Now, is this the loser? You had said something to me about it. You have eliminated this.
Well, not yet, but it's on the verge because there's a few factors. Of course, you're only seeing the final fruit. And We have to look at the tree and how productive it is and that sort of thing. So
I like this one.
Well, we'll keep it for you.
Now this big beauty, which looks like a lot of other apples now. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, softer flesh again. Nice acid touch. Really, almost stone fruit-like.
Interesting.
Yeah. And yet apple-y, it's delicious.
Oh, that's good. Well, that is our second from newest introduction. That's Zestar. And so that's an apple that's just in season right now. We just introduced it a few years ago, so it's just making its way to the market.
So this has already passed the test.
That has, yeah. That's one out of the 10,000 that were thrown away that did survive.
David, how long does it take from trying out the seed to actually getting the apple in the supermarket?
Well, a rough rule of thumb is 25 to 30 years. Honeycrisp took 30 years. So
you might develop an apple and not live to see it actually in the market.
Very possible. The only thing I can hope is that eating all these apples every day will prolong my life. That's the only way I'll get to see them.
David, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. David Bedford is the University of Minnesota's apple breeder. And David, if you're listening, please don't give up on that homely little apple. It tastes so good. It'd be perfect in my apple citron turnover. Now, you can get that recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Russ Parsons covers food for the LA Times from every imaginable angle. Now, I know Russ's writing. It's smart and it's tight and it never gets flowery. Purple Prose and Russ Parsons have never met. Until now, with his article called Seduction by Fig. Russ, it's good to have you back.
I like purple prose. That's very appropriate for a fig, isn't it?
I think it is. But, you know, I always think of you as such a down-to-earth writer. And now I'm wondering if you're in love because, now I'm going to quote. This is in the first paragraph of the article. You don't so much bite into a fig as engage it in a long, sweet kiss.
Well, I'm very much in love, not just with figs, but I've been married for 30 years, so it's pretty remarkable, I guess, actually, isn't it? I think it was too many days out in the fig fields in Fresno at like 110 degrees. it's one of those funny things because people talk about figs and they talk about, you know, their peculiar biology and how they're grown and how to cook them. But, you know, the fig is just one of those fruits that you can't avoid the sensual aspect of it because it's just so in your face. I had a very funny email from a reader who said the first time somebody handed him a fresh fig, he bit into it and he blushed.
But the point you make in the article is that we really are seeing now a lot of fresh figs available across the country.
Right. The increase is pretty remarkable. I mean, it's basically tripled in the last 10 years. And as with all agriculture, there's a good business reason behind it. Basically, what happened is that the dried fig market, which had been kind of the main, that's what most figs were grown for, has just become pretty treacherous. I think the real wake-up call for the fig industry was when Nabisco started introducing apple Newtons and blueberry Newtons and all of these kinds of things, and that one change by that one company cut American consumption of dried figs in half.
Wow.
In 1 year. And so, you know, what they have all these figs, and so what are they going to do with them? So they started trying to sell them fresh, and they found that when they started selling them fresh, people went nuts for them, and they got a great price for it, and so it's a real win-win proposition.
Okay, so now we're going to be able to buy fresh figs.
Mm-hmm.
But I know one thing. You bite into an unripe fig, and you may never go back for another one. So I'd like you to give us some information. First of all, how should we buy a fig? How do we tell if it's ripe? What kind should we look for?
The best way to tell if a fig is ripe is by touch.
Okay.
A ripe fig is soft.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's an old Spanish saying that the best fig wears beggar's robes and a widow's tear. And that's actually kind of that's not just poetry. Really great figs will have cracks in the outside.
Oh, and you'll actually see some of the juice.
Yes, and with really, really sweet figs, you'll see there's a little hole at the bottom of the fig that's called the eye, and there will be a little bit of nectar dripping out of that, a little syrup.
Huh.
There are basically two kinds of figs that you'll find, green figs and black figs.
Uh-huh.
There's a really great green fig called a Calamurna, and if you see those labeled by variety, pick them up. Otherwise, to be honest with you, I would avoid green figs because a lot of those are cadotas, it's a type of fig that's grown specifically for drying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a really thick skin, which is great for drying or for canning or for doing those other kinds of things, but it's not great for eating fresh. Black figs are usually either black missions or brown turkeys,
mm-hmm.
and those are great figs.
Russ, can you ripen figs at home?
No, you really can't. Sometimes if you get figs that are really firm, like if you buy them in a box, there will be some that are dead ripe and some that aren't.
Right.
You can set the ones that are firm aside and they will soften, but technically that's not ripening. It's actually just breaking down a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Figs are not climacteric fruits. They don't, like a peach or tomato or something like that, they don't ripen after they've been picked.
Okay. Hey, Russ, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Russ Parsons covers food for the LA Times. His article, Seduction by Fig, appeared in the September 6, 2006 edition of the paper. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. And appropriately, the question is, where did the expression, I don't give a fig, come from? We're going to have that answer in a moment. And we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas and a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where did the expression, "I don't give a fig," come from? Well, I can imagine what you're thinking, and you are wrong. In Old England, where the expression started, figs were little withered things, hard as rocks. The Oxford English Dictionary says fig meant worthless, and it proves it with quotes that start way back in the 15th century. Now, around the 16th century, Elizabeth I's troubles with Spain led to a fig gesture, a rude one. It involved the thumb and two other fingers, and it was actually called the Spanish fig. Okay, let's roll up to today. First, you may want to know that the fig isn't a fruit. Botanically, it is a flower. Second, its closest relative is the rubber tree. And third, on a pragmatic note, I checked out how long you can keep fresh figs, because they go pretty fast once they're ripe. Unless you can hold them, and I quote, at 40 to 43 degrees Fahrenheit with 75% humidity. And I say, forget it. Have figs for supper. The figs with cheese first, then with lamb, and then straight fig for dessert. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Hefty OneZip. Pick up that phone, guys. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's get going. Now, we have Rebecca calling from Athens, Ohio. Hey, Rebecca, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you doing, Lynn?
I am doing well.
Good, I'm glad. I moved into a dorm room, and I requested a dorm with a kitchen. Of course, I didn't get it. So,
I remember what I requested in my dorm, but that was another issue.
Oh. Yes. Well, so all I have to cook with is a microwave for the next year. And I was wondering if you had suggestions as to good foods to cook that weren't like mac and cheese or
right,
hot pot.
Right, or reheat something that you've done on takeout and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, the very first thing that comes to mind is probably the great tome that was written on microwave, and I think it may have even come out in the 80s or the early 90s, but it's out there. I think it's simply called Microwave Cooking, but it's by Barbara Kafka. K-A-F-K-A. And when Barbara tackles a subject, it becomes a doctorate's thesis. But the thing that she did, she took, now this is a really serious, you know, very upscale cook and a very, very serious researcher. And Barbara decided there was no reason why you couldn't learn to cook great food in the microwave. Now, some of the recipes tend to be a bit belabored, but the information in the book is some of the best I've ever seen. And she really calls the shots as she sees them. And this is what I remember. The anything you can do with liquid and vegetables works brilliantly in the microwave. Vegetables work in the microwave. Liquid-based things that are based on broth or whatever. So now you're looking at soups and sauces, making your own chicken soup. I remember that was one of the marvels for people, that she actually made really good and very quick chicken soup in the microwave, starting with chicken. You know. The other thing she pointed out that I recall that I found really interesting is that fish and shellfish does really well.
Shellfish?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fish and shellfish, and I think it has to do with the structure of the beast, that there's not a lot of connective tissue to break down. Whatever the reason is. Now, you can't brown in a microwave. I think you know that.
Yeah, okay.
But the thing you can do is anything that would be poached, anything that would be stewed, could go in there. Let me give you an instance off the top of my head.
Okay.
Small cubes of beef, Chinese beef, all right? Mm-hmm. Toss the beef with soy sauce, a bit of sugar, some wine, and maybe Chinese five spice powder, which you can find in some supermarkets, or you can just use aniseed and cinnamon and clove.
Oh, five spice?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, but you know what I'm saying? If you don't find five spice, you can do a mixture.
Yeah.
You could throw in something hot and spicy if you wanted. You add a bit of broth, okay? Mm-hmm. Now you put that in the microwave, and you follow whatever the instructions are for cooking. You know, I think it would be probably 10 minutes on high, but you have to turn it and stir it and that kind of thing. You have a fabulous stew. You can make rice in the microwave very easily. Now you have dinner. And you have it in a lot less time than it would take on top of a stove.
Well, that's good.
You see what I'm saying? Do you follow the reasoning?
Yeah, I see how that would work. I just, you know, didn't want to end up with a bunch of rubber tasting food all the time.
No. I think first of all, read the booklet that comes with it with the instructions. That's important. Get your hands on Barbara's book. And maybe look at, are you going to have to buy the microwave?
No, it's supplied.
It's supplied. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But I'd say Barbara above, I know there are a ton of books out there on microwave, but Barbara's is really incredible.
Okay.
And you know what else you can do in it that's really cool? You could take something like olive oil, a good tasting fat, and add to it whatever spices or seasonings you want, and that goes into the microwave for just a few moments. It infuses that fat with flavor, and then that goes on the 7-minute baked potato that you made. That goes on the takeout chicken that you got. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
3 minutes, 2 minutes in a microwave, you've already done the fish. That's sitting there waiting, and then you do some sort of great sauce that maybe is going to be about, you know, lemon zest and tarragon and white wine and butter.
Yum.
So you're now cooking like a real person.
Yes, that's what I'm looking for.
As opposed to reheating a burrito. Nothing wrong with a burrito.
Sometimes too.
Yeah, well, exactly. You're a student. You know, you may not have all the time in the world. But this is a good thing. Yeah, and I'd say get Barbara's book. You're going to be home free.
I will do that. Thank you so much.
You are really welcome, and enjoy.
All right.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. Okay, who's up next? We've got Andrea calling from Chatfield, Minnesota. Andrea.
Hi, Lynn. I've been growing a variety of garlic for about 7 years now.
Oh, how many kinds?
Oh, anywhere between 5 and 10, depending on the year.
Wow.
And I never get around to actually comparing the varieties side by side.
Yeah.
I've got some friends who've been waiting for me to have a garlic tasting. So this year I want to finally plan a garlic tasting event, and I'm wondering if you have any good ideas, if it would be a good idea to taste the garlic raw. And if so, with what? And roasted, if you have any new ideas for roasted garlic or baked garlic?
I'm just thinking, okay, now your goal is to taste these garlics to really discern what differences there might be.
Right.
So the simpler the garlic, the better. But if you take bites of raw garlic, it's going to cancel out whatever you eat next.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about.
It's kind of like tasting vinegar. You know, you have to...
Some of it's... super hot and spicy.
Right. All right. First of all, I think I'd arrange... This is what I do. I would take each kind of garlic, give it a bowl, and I would chop up some of it. And the idea is that it's a sniffing bowl. So you sniff that garlic, and that's how you take it in the raw state. Mm-hmm. You see? Because scent is so much a part of what we taste anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's how you experience the raw garlic. And then I would pick a really neutral carrier of the garlic, like it might be a flavorless cold-pressed vegetable oil, maybe sweet butter, except sweet butter has so much flavor on its own. But this is what I would do. I would just poach the garlic, sliced up very gently in that, whatever that neutral carrier is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you either taste it that way or you put it over something neutral like rice.
Okay.
Just white rice. And that way, people can start to taste, this is how this garlic cooks. Mm-hmm. And it's just salt and pepper. That's the purest way to do it. Now, once you've done that, then you can have a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is what you could do. I mean, one of the fun things to do would be maybe is to take each head. And again, I'd keep it pretty simple. Drizzle it do the roasting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Take heads of each one. Cut off the top third, put them in baking dishes, drizzle them with a generous amount of olive oil, salt, and pepper, and then roast them at about 400 degrees until they're soft. And then squeeze that out on bread and that kind of thing. The other thing I would do is, I mean, I couldn't resist doing a garlic pasta where you just saute that garlic slow in a generous amount of olive oil. You might want to throw in some fresh basil and you toss that with some pasta and let everybody just dig in. Have some Parmigiano Reggiano on the side. And that, you know, do that kind of very simple stuff. The other thing that might be interesting to try is to take something like plums and sear them in butter with garlic and some vinegar and maybe a few raisins and a little hot chili. That has nothing to do with tasting the garlic. It just might be a fun thing to do.
You know,
garlic.
I actually have plums growing on the tree right now.
You do?
Just about right.
Why don't you try garlic plums?
That sounds good.
You know, you might be on your way to a garlic chutney.
Yeah.
That might be pretty cool. Anyway, that's the basic idea. But I'd say that sniffing is going to really give everybody a very good idea of what they're dealing with.
Okay.
Okay?
Great ideas.
Hey,
thank you.
Great to grow all that garlic. I'm jealous.
Yeah.
I'm paying a lot of money for those different kinds of garlic.
I'll send you some.
I love it.
Okay.
I would love it. Hey, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We've got Pam calling from San Antonio. Pam, what do you want to talk about?
First of all, I love your show.
Thank you.
And I don't know what a slurry is and how you would use it. I've heard of it expressed by a friend of mine who is a really good baker. And he said, well, make a slurry. What's that? Now, he told me, but I didn't understand it. So,
what did he say?
Something about putting it in a food processor and putting cornstarch.
Yeah.
He was kind of like, you know, like I knew what he was talking about. But
And I know. It's when people start out thinking. They start at a point in explaining something where they assume you know a great deal and you are hesitant to admit. It's like
right. I was just standing there going, uh-huh.
Yeah, I do that with computer people a lot. Yeah. I nod, and I feel like if I ask them, what in heaven's name are you talking about one more time, they'll just leave the room. This is what I know about a slurry. It's a method of thickening that involves just liquid and the thickener. So it could be flour and water. It could be cornstarch and water.
Oh, yeah, that's what he's saying is cornstarch.
Yeah, and the idea is that what you want to do is always add the liquid to the cornstarch or the flour or the arrowroot or the potato starch rather than the starch to the water because then you can never get the lumps out.
Uh-huh.
You see? And I mean, I make a slurry every Thanksgiving because I always thicken my Thanksgiving gravy with
one. Oh, my God, I do too.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it.
Yeah, you were making a slurry. And I just put the flour, and I use flour. I put the flour in the bottom of a tall drinking glass, and then I add some cold water, and I beat it with a fork until it's... And then I boil. And yes, you know, you have to bring a slurry to a boil and cook out any raw taste it might have because flour, cornstarch just cooks instantaneously and thickens instantaneously. But flour takes time to cook. You can get that raw flour taste, but it's a thickening agent and it's usually a little on the watery side.
Okay.
Yeah.
And well, great.
And it's liquid and whatever thickener there might be.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. And now you can just...
That was a lot easier to understand.
Well, you can just sort of drop it in conversation with him now and say, you know, okay. The other day I was doing a little finish on my sauté and I did a bit of a slurry, but this time I used flour.
Hopefully he's not listening.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Good question.
Bye-bye.
You take care. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Well, right now in Sutherland, Massachusetts, you can find Julia Child in a cornfield, but you're going to need a plane to see her. Artist Will Sillin has created a maze in a cornfield that is Julia Child wielding a meat mallet. Now, William is on the phone. William, this is quite amazing. How did you come up with this idea?
I have to give full credit to my sister-in-law, who suggested the idea one night on the phone while I was with Mike, the farmer. And when she said Julia Child, I knew it was right, and I ran into the next room and I got a copy of Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And on the cover was Julia holding aloft that meat tenderizer with a big smile.
Well, I went onto your website and I've seen that you have done Einstein one year. You did John Kerry and George Bush another year. You have done the Mona Lisa. Why a corn maze?
Well, the corn maze actually came first. And then it was like, well, what are we going to do? There's so many corn mazes. What are we going to do to, you know, get that attention that we need to bring people to our maze?
Mm-hmm.
And I settled on the idea of doing a portrait after my sister-in-law suggested the Mona Lisa, and that worked out really well. So we've been doing portraits since then.
This is what I can't understand. How do you work on the ground and keep in mind the perspective that you can only really see what this is about from hundreds of feet above? What's the trick to that?
Well, it's like an elementary school art project where you have an image on one sheet of paper and you want to transfer it to another sheet of paper.
Uh-huh.
And I use a grid. And in the same way that, you know, I guess your finger doesn't know what it's doing. I mean, I can't see what I'm doing, but I trust the system of working on a grid from my drawing up to the field. And I have a grid because the corn is cross-planted.
So does the farmer plant specifically for a maize?
Yes. He cross-plants it twice as thick to encourage people to really stay on the trails.
I see. And then you cut the corn?
Yeah.
When wow.
When it's real short, though.
What's your background?
I am an artist, and I have my background is I was a liberal arts history major in college and started pursuing art after college. And I've done scientific illustration and paleontological-type reconstructions and just straight landscape art when I have time, easel paintings.
And now you use a tractor instead of a brush.
Yeah, well, Mike uses the tractor. I use the weed whacker.
But I, one of the things that intrigued me about looking at this and thinking about it was, why did you choose the maize? Because I think of as maize was an old ancient tool for, in some cases, spiritual experience, coming together with the universe. Is any of that figuring into this, or is it just, boy, is this great to do with a big field of corn and it's fun to play with the perspective?
Boy, that's a wild question. I think, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to give a total escape, just some goofy, outdoor, good, clean fun. And so I like what you said about that energy and that sort of that universal communication, because when you see a little kid or a family come out of the maze, they're exhausted, mm-hmm. but they're happy. And they feel like they've accomplished something at the same time as they've had a lot of fun. So I think we're on the same wavelength. You go back and look at the definition of what recreation is, and it is to recreate, to begin anew. So I think we're trying to get a little bit of that in on a Sunday afternoon.
If you hear someone in the middle of the maze going, you'll know they really got it.
All right.
Will, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, I really appreciate the call. Thank you for calling.
William Sillin is an artist who creates corn mazes each year. Now, you can find the Julia Child maze at the Warner Farm in Sunderland, Massachusetts. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for calling us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau. He said, "I believe in the forest and in the meadow and in the night in which the corn grows." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today, and so much more, can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters, Weeknight Kitchen and Baker's Chronicle. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek and to get you baking over the weekend. You can also download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. So sign up for it all. Online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Hefty, maker of Hefty OneZip, a food storage bag designed so that the rest of the family can close it. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with help from intern Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.